This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Well, this is a bit of a novelty. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. As all of you Skybet Championship supporters contemplate several weeks without domestic football. Fear not, though, the 22nd running of the World Cup is about to get underway and fill the gap. Not that we'll be forgetting that Skybet Leagues 1 and 2 carry on as normal. And that's why we're chatting on this episode to one of the lower league's biggest names.
I remember I was that kid that you think people are just getting on you or people are just in the games. If you do something wrong, even though you're a 16-year-old kid, you're still getting hammered by some of the older lads. And I think now I look back and I'm like, I was that young kid.
Meanwhile, never happier than when he's talking about football at any level is this man.
This is what I'm talking about. There's winners and there's learners. You know, you don't lose in football. You just got to get up and the next morning, dust yourself down and get on with it, Clem. You know the score.
It's the official EFL podcast. So let's start this episode by talking to a striker who's currently plying his trade at the bottom of League One, but who in the recent past has twice been transferred to Premier League clubs for multi-million pound fees. Firstly from Ipswich Town to Sunderland and then on to Crystal Palace. But for a long-term injury setback, he might still be playing in the top flight. Instead, he's had a nomadic last 18 months. On a more positive note, if he tries to tell us he's not watched his second goal for Forest Green Rovers in their recent FA Cup win against non-league South Shields back at least 100 times, he's simply not telling the truth. We should set the scene, I suppose, Connor. For those that might have missed it, it was in the dying minutes. You scored from the halfway line. Have you ever done anything remotely similar before in your career?
I had the one, obviously the one at Ipswich that was... I think the ball was up in the air and it came down. I controlled it and went probably three quarters of length of the pitch and then ended up scoring at the end. But in terms of from the halfway line, no, never.
So how does the feeling compare, the one you've just described at the start of your career, to the one the weekend before last?
Obviously, like, I think they're both great goals, even flat for me. But when I was young, it was more just like a raw mentality. It's like, I'm just gonna go. And it wasn't even a case that there wasn't anyone to pass to. It was, I'm just going to keep going and keep going. And then the next thing I know, I was in the box with just the defender and the goalkeeper in front of me. And I remember I thought, I'm going to place this in on with my right foot. So I chopped it back with my left. And as I chopped it back, the keeper dived and the defender slid in. So then I chopped back the other way. And then managed to put it in the corner with my left foot.
So you've never scored from the halfway line before?
I've wanted to try it for a while because I've noticed lately that a few keepers... Now, I don't know if it's because people want keepers to come out and play with the back line and use them as almost like a really high centre-back or a really deep centre-back, as you say.
And is that what happened when you were playing South Shields?
The keeper kept standing on the edge of his box and I thought, if I get the opportunity and it sits nicely, I'm just going to go for it. And... you know, it come off. And when I first hit it, I thought, oh, it's got a chance. And then it started to go a bit to the right and I thought, oh, it's going a bit, it's going to hit the post. And then luckily it just dropped in the back of the net, which was perfect, really.
And that instinct, Connor, did you have time to properly assess where the keeper was? Or were you working on a hunch that he would be in that kind of similar area that you'd spotted him earlier in the match?
When the ball came out, when we cleared it, and I think it dropped a Kyle in the middle, and I thought, if he rolls the ball to me, there's a defender in front of me and two behind me. And I thought, all I can do is kind of hold it up. And when I turned, I thought, I just looked up, saw the keeper, and thought, just go for it. And I didn't even have that time to think, no, don't, or... do or don't or whatever. It was literally, he's off his line, go for it. And that was it. And it was just, before I could even stop myself doing it, I'd already done it. And then I think if I'd have waited any longer, if the keeper manages to get a yard back or I take half a second longer, he might tip it over because he was getting back. But then, you know, as I said, it was just one of them things. The opportunity was there and I just didn't even think twice, really, just went for it.
And because it was on BBC One, I'm assuming before you'd got back in the changing rooms, when you flicked your phone back on or got it out of your pocket or something, I bet the thing was electric, wasn't it? It was just pinging every 2 seconds.
Yeah, it was, to be fair. I think because it was a TV game, it was obviously broadcasted a lot more. And it was obviously live, so it would have probably got a lot more kind of an audience. But yeah, my phone was non-stop that day. Even now, like, I get when the FA Instagram or Twitter page, they repost it, I just keep getting messages and messages of, like, but when I watch it back, I think, oh, it's not that far out. But then when I'm stood on a pitch today at training, I think, yeah, actually it's quite far.
I'm so pleased you're so passionate about this, because sometimes somebody scores a worldie like this and you go, oh yeah, come on then, how many times? And they're like, they're trying to play it down and things, but I can see how excited it's made you. How many times have you watched it back, do you think?
Yeah, I've watched it a few, to be fair. I've watched it quite a few.
How many's a few?
I mean, when I open Twitter, it's just always there.
That old excuse, eh?
Yeah, so if it's there, it's really rude not to watch it again.
So obviously, having had that weekend that you had then, you do seem to be in a very good place. You have been a bit of a nomad the last season and a half. What, I mean, does this feel right for you? Is there something about this? Give or take, yeah, obviously, it's a bit of a challenge you've got on your hands in terms of where the club is, trying to fight to establish themselves in the division. But personally, you in a good place?
Yeah, personally, I am. I mean, it was... I suffered that injury at Preston, and that honestly was probably one of the lowest points in my career. Even after doing my ACL, I think the hamstring injury I got at Preston was honestly one of the lowest points of my career, even mentally. And that was simply because when I did my ACL, I hadn't had a pass of injury after injury, and feeling like I was progressing, and then boom, I was hit with something else. But I'm feeling really good now. Obviously, as you said, I left Preston and then went to Milton Keynes, who at the time were absolutely flying. I knew Liam Manning from when I was at Ipswich years and years ago. I think he was under 15s or 16s, maybe even younger. And Liam Sweeting, who had come from Palace over to MK Dons, so I knew some of the coaching staff, and that kind of made me fall back in love with football again in a way. Not that I fell out of love with it, but it made me, because they were so close to achieving something that would have been so good. It gave me that love back again, that kind of spark, and the fact that I thought, I don't want to stop. I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to stop at the playoffs. I didn't want to stop. I wanted to win that whole playoff thing, which for me, then in my head, when I'm thinking, oh, I've had all these injuries, X, Y, Z, now the contract was coming to an end at Milton Keynes, and I was just desperate then to get back into playing football, and I didn't really mind that we had a short break that year, because it means that once my agent had found me somewhere, then someone had come to the, someone had picked up the phone for him, that I would be back playing again. And, I've signed at Forest Green, and as you said, it's a challenge, obviously, because of they've come up, they lost a few of their players at the start of the season, and I haven't played League Two, but I imagine it's going to be a big step up. Like League One to the Championship is a big step up. And there's some massive teams in League One now that probably shouldn't even be there. But I'm enjoying playing football, and I'm back playing football week in, week out, playing Saturdays, Tuesdays. And, I had people that were saying it's not fit, can't last these amount of games, couldn't last 2-3 weeks, can't do Saturday, Tuesday, can't do this, can't do that. And now it feels like I'm starting to get back to my old self that's playing Saturday, Tuesday, that's scoring goals, that's kind of, my name's getting back in people's mouths, which is obviously a good thing for me. But at the end of the day, playing football was the most important thing to me, and I've got that love back for the game, and you know, I'm enjoying every single day now that I go in and train, and just looking forward to the match days and showing what I can do again.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine both physically but also mentally what a 2-year hiatus, which is what you had with your ACL, you describe, but Palace kind of takes out of you. I mean, it takes crucial football years, obviously, on the field, but the levels of resilience and persistence you must have had to learn must be off the scale, aren't they?
Yeah, it was. I mentioned the hamstring one that I had at Preston, and that was probably more difficult to handle than my ACL. And that's probably down to the fact that before I'd done my ACL, I hadn't really had any injuries before that had been long-term, maybe like the odd calf that had kept me out a week or two. But before that, I can't remember when the injuries I had. And then from my ACL, it was almost, when it happened, I knew straight away. And I didn't know what the feeling was. I didn't know that I'd done my ACL, but I knew it wasn't good. I knew that this, when I felt the twist, I thought, this is bad. And in your head, you almost process that easier because you half know what it's going to be. You know how long the time frame is. You can't cheat an ACL. You can't cheat the rehab. You can't cut corners anywhere in that rehab or that process. And mentally, I thought to myself, right, it's going to be 9 to 12 months and I can't change it. I can't sit and cry about it every day. I can't sit and be like, oh, why has it happened to me? What if? And obviously you have to obviously absorb them feelings, them emotions that when they come in, but it's then how quickly you can change that into being right. It's 9 to 12 months and you just got to get on with it and you just got to get it done. And it's a grind and it's times like, I think I'd done mine, it might be the end of November, maybe the end of November, when obviously it's dark in the mornings, it's getting dark early. So you're going to training, you're getting in for probably 8 o'clock, which then it's still not even really light. Then you're leaving the training ground at 3:30, 4, where it's starting to get dark and it's then the miserable nights. And obviously it's not very, it wouldn't be the easiest thing to kind of keep that momentum going and that mindset for that long. But once you get over the fact that, you know, it's going to be 9 to 12 months, that for me was easier than I'd gone into a tackle at Preston. And it wasn't as if I was sprinting or I jumped and something happened. I was forced into a position that was unnatural. And then it did what it did to my hamstring. And that was more frustrating because I thought, this isn't something that I haven't been, this isn't me physically where I've sprinted and pulled my hamstring. This is just bad luck. This just can't be happening to me. So it was easier to accept the ACL because I knew the time frame, I knew it was going to be, and I hadn't had any history before. And then the Preston one was, I'd had the history of being like, of getting over injuries, getting over. Finally, I got to a place at Preston where I was fit. I trained for probably 3 months before that, 2 or 3 months with Preston before that, even before that game. And then boom, it's just all taken. It's just all, it's like a carpet just got pulled from under your feet after 2 minutes of the game. It was just, that was the hardest thing.
I'm just trying to think of your kind of decade because I was lucky enough to be hosting the Football League Awards back 11 years ago when you won Young Player of the Year and Apprentice of the Year. And you had a heck of a lot of adulation. You were trying to keep your feet on the ground. You scored that worldie goal for Ipswich. I mean, I wonder how that kid then thought the next decade might play out. And I also wonder what Conor Wickham now would say to that young kid back then.
There's obviously a couple of players in the team that are a bit more experienced, like myself, in terms of age. And we always say, when you're that kid who's 16 and you've got someone who, obviously now in the changing room, I would be almost a senior figure but only at 29, I'm a senior figure. And when you try to explain to the boys coming through, the 16, 17 year olds, and you try and talk to them, and you can see them looking at you thinking, oh, what's he talking about? And I was that, I remember I was that kid that you think people are just getting on you, or people are just in the games. If you do something wrong, even though you're a 16 year old kid, you're still getting hammered by some of the older lads. And I think now I look back and I'm like, I was that young kid who was saying like, oh, just let me play my football, just let me. And but now I kind of take that approach and let the boys kind of learn. But if they need advice, obviously I'll speak to them and try and give them advice on when to play, try and speak to the boys about what I know about the game or how I feel like we can do stuff better in that experience. And obviously you never know how your whole career is going to pan out. You never know. You know, I could have won those awards, as you said, and then 2 years later completely disappeared off the scene. It's just, you just, football can change overnight.
You know what, Connor? Life can change overnight. I don't think any of us are ever ready for the changes that come along. There'll be a little cycle in life. There'll be something that we do and enjoy doing, and then all of a sudden, it's suddenly over quicker than you expect it to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's just why you've just got to take every opportunity when it comes, really. I mean, when you're 16, 17, 18, like I was when I was picking up them awards, you don't know how. You're almost naive to what the future's going to hold. You're naive to, you know, when I left Ipswich and I went to Sunderland, I was naive to the fact of, obviously, you know, everyone knows the Premier League, but you're a bit naive into the fact that I was a kid going into that environment, into the big, big worldwide of Premier League football. And it is 10 times more, you know, 10 times quicker, 10 times stronger. You got to think quicker. People are so much more intense. There's so many more staff around the place to help. And you see how much goes into those teams in that league. And then you understand, you know, what you have, the level you have to get to make it successfully into that league and stay in that league.
And you had the other element there at Sunderland, I guess, as well, which was, when you've got a club that keeps fighting to stay in the division and changing their manager, and then you've got to get used to that. The guy that signs you is not the guy now managing you and might not see the strengths in you that the previous person. That's a lot to take on for a young kid as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There's so much that goes into it, and it's all kind of, you know, different managers prefer different players, different systems, different formations. They have different philosophies. You know, I went into a Sunderland team that was, I think the summer that I signed, they probably had an overhaul of maybe like 10 players. And I was then kind of in, as an 18-year-old kid, I was in the change room with kind of Wes Brown and John O'Shea. These boys had won numerous Premier League titles, Champions Leagues, every cup. And then the next minute I'm sitting next to them. And it was, you then become, you're at that point, then you're not in awe of these players. They're like, they're your teammates. And it just becomes kind of the normal situation. It was even for me, like playing against the players that I'd looked up to, like Fernando Torres was growing up. He was like the one who was, when I was probably like 13, 14, 15, he was the man, do you know what I mean? And then when I finally got to play against him, I was thinking, that's Fernando, it's like my hero, do you know what I mean? And but then as you get in, obviously the seasons go by, it just becomes the norm then, which is incredible, really.
You're making me feel incredibly old. Fernando Torres feels like he was about 5 years ago or something, for you to suddenly be telling me is half your lifetime ago that you were looking up to. Is there, aside from maybe not going into a challenge that caused you a big injury, is there one thing you would do differently with your career, Connor? If the answer's no, that's fine. I'm not. It's not that wasn't a loaded question. I'm sort of almost relieved that you're having to fish for an answer to that one.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I would do anything different in my career, but obviously injuries, you can't predict an injury that's going to happen. You can't predict, you know, the future with injury wise. But no, I wouldn't, because you never know. If I chose a different path, who knows what have happened? Who knows what might have happened? What might not have happened? I could have, you know, gone to a different team, gone to a different area, and something could have happened that could have been, you know, anything could have happened. But, you know, I'm proud of the career I've had. I'm happy with the career I've had. Obviously, I still feel like I've got, in footballing terms, in the dressing room, I'm kind of one of the experienced. But nowadays, players are playing to 36, 37 years old. You know, potentially still got another 7-8 years. And yeah. I believe in those 7 to 8 years that, you know, I've still got the quality, I've still got the hunger, I've still got, you know, the ability to play at the highest level. That's what I believe. I just need to get fit and show it. And, you know, I'm being given the opportunity now at Forest Green to kind of get fit, show what I can do. And, you know, when I was a young kid, it was, you just play football and whatever comes with football, you're not playing, going, I'm going to play well just to get a move. I'm going to play well just so people see me. You just have to play well and play well and play well and not think about what goes on the outside and let the outside deal with that itself. And you just do what you need to do on the pitch, because ultimately that's what's going to determine how far you go.
Yeah, well, you've been doing that for a long time. You were doing that when there was all those accolades at Ipswich and everybody was linking you to big moves. And I think you were always quite level-headed there, weren't you? And tried not to read too much of it and just concentrate. I hate the phrase, just concentrate on the next game that's coming up. But it is one of those fundamental principles of football. Tell me, you did allude to... And I don't want to overdwell on the injury thing because we discussed it a lot, but you did allude to perhaps perceptions of you and stuff. Is that one of the key things for you now, to have an injury-free season, bang in a load of goals, and fingers crossed, I guess it shows people that you're still there, still have a hell of a lot to offer?
Yeah, I think because I still feel like I've got so much to give, and I don't want to carry the burden of people saying, oh, he's injured, he's this, he's not capable of doing that. And I know, because I know I am. I always knew I have been. And, you know, as I just said, I'm being given that opportunity now at Forest Green. I know my body inside out now. And I've got, you know, coaching staff and physios I work with. And obviously the coaching staff, the physios, the team at Forest Green, to be honest, they're unbelievable with managing my training loads so that I can recover properly at home. And what I do at home, then, you know, if I'm not feeling 100%, they'll, you know, you can manage loads, you can manage training sessions and recovery sessions and put in extra days off feet if you need. And that's what they've given me, really, is a platform that I'm being able to train often, train every day, and be there on a Saturday, be there on a Tuesday, and, you know, turn up and feel good. And it's just what I've needed, really, is a bit of you know, adaptation in terms of the training side of it and the loading and the physical attributes. And then once I get on the pitch, that's when, you know, that's the most important day of the week. There's a Saturday and a Tuesday. So, you know, I'm getting there regularly every week. So, you know, I think that is the doubts that people have had in me previously, is not my ability or not the fact that, you know, my qualities. It's, well, can he stay fit? And now I'm managing to do that. So I'm feeling like I'm in a really good place at the moment.
The quality's in no doubt. They only need to go and click on Twitter, as you had to watch your goal back 100 times. Finally, I'm going to mention those words, persistence, resilience, again. If somebody's listening to this and they're going through a bit of a, let's say, challenging time, what would your advice be to them?
In the injury, in the football side of it?
I don't know, sort of messages we could draw from your experiences over the last few years.
What helped me a bit, and I touched on it earlier on today actually, and when I was speaking to someone, is the fact that in the industry we're in, we're so lucky, we're so blessed to be where we are. We get it easy, really. And there's so many more people in the world, you know, that are not as fortunate as we are, not in the position we are. We're able to do something that, you know, we love every single day and get paid well for it. And people, you know, there's people that aren't that fortunate, people that are sick, people that aren't well, people that do have problems. There's always someone else there that's worse than you. And I think, you know, that's kind of what got me through is I've got an injury in my calf, an injury to my knee that's going to keep me out for a year, but someone could have something that's going on for, they might have to have treatment for the next 4 or 5 years. And kind of snapped me out of feeling sorry for myself and, right, get this done. And then your time will come. So there's always someone worse off than you are as well.
Keep going. It's been an inspirational chat. I'm so pleased for you. You got that goal. You can go away and watch it another 100 times now. Thanks for talking to us on the Official EFL Podcast.
Take care. Thanks very much.
The Official EFL Podcast with Mark Clement.
He's managed Derby County, Hull City, who he led to the Premier League for the first time in their then 104-year history. Preston North End, Southend United twice, winning the League Two playoffs in his first spell, plus Swindon Town and Barrow. Is there a better guest to have on this week's Official EFL Podcast with such a broad range of football matters to discuss than Phil Brown? We are of a similar era, Philip. I'm assuming you, like me, have now got the spreadsheet out, the World Cup wall chart. You're starting to look, and suddenly that dawning realization that from Tuesday of next week onwards, you can sit down and watch a 10 o'clock, a 1 o'clock, a 4 o'clock, and I can't remember, is it an 8 o'clock, the evening kickoff time? But what a football fiesta. Feast, whatever word you want to use, looming. Are you excited?
Clem, I did fighting talk on Saturday and I got asked a question, you know, how am I hot or cold with regards to the World Cup? And at the moment, I'm cold. I know I'm going to get boiling hot. I know exactly how it's going to go. Yes, your spreadsheet's out and you flip. You know, everything's just building up nicely and the squad's named. And then all I was at St. George's last week when the squad was named and there was an excitement about there. The whole thing is pointing towards a great game against Wales, and qualifiers will count upon it. You know, they'll rely upon all the things that you expect before the World Cup will guarantee happen. I hope it goes well. I hope it goes smoothly. I mean, there's been a lot of politics regarding negativity and this, that, and the other. But once the first ball's kicked, everybody forgets about the politics and just gets on with the game of football, or at least I hope they do. And I think we've got a chance. And I always go into a competition as an Englishman, a proud Englishman. You know, ever since this 66 World Cup, we always go into it thinking we're going to win it. And nothing's changed. I'm expecting something to change over the course of the last 40, 50 years, and hasn't. Every time we go to a competition. But I have to say it, I think Gareth has been an outstanding candidate to get the England job after Sam, and he's grabbed a hold of it. But more importantly, you know, the guys I'm talking to in the media, it's handling them is the biggest part of the job. When I was at St. George's, I got an invitation by the League Managers Association to come and watch a session with Gareth Southgate and Steve Holland. I couldn't refuse. You know, that's how much I'm into the England setup. I couldn't refuse it. So I go to, you know, pack your bags and get yourself off to St. George's and go to see this full day of Gareth Southgate and Steve Holland. Gareth's stuck in traffic coming down from Middlesbrough and he cannot get to the gig for 9:30 start. So consequently, Steve Holland, he just has to take over because, you know, that's the assistant manager's role, as it were. That's the first team coach's kid. You know, the manager's stuck, take over. He put on a session in the indoor arena and it was outstanding. The way he got his points of view across and the great guys that he's worked with, you know, Ancelotti at Chelsea and people like that. You could tell from the session he had gathered all this information from these great coaches, great managers, and he was putting a show on for everybody. And eventually, if the session finished and we go into the hall, and Gareth arrives. And Gareth said, well, that worked well, didn't it? He said, you can now see who coaches England, and I manage England. Now, managing England is managing you guys, managing the media, managing the expectancy levels of, you know, the effect we have in England on our national team. And I think he's done a brilliant job at it. Probably just in the last 6 months has been his biggest test, because some of the results haven't gone his way, as it were. But, you know, semi-final, then a final. He's one step away from winning a final. And I think there's no reason why we can't, apart from the fact that the Welsh are in the way. And you look at the Welsh squad and you look at the English squad and you go, well, that's a Premier League squad. That's a Championship squad. It matters not. It doesn't care. It doesn't. When Wales play England, if the winner goes on to win the group or this, that and the other, which is quite possible, if the winner goes on to win the group and then has a great final 16 stage, then Wales are in our way. We've got to bring our A game to the table. We've got to make sure that Premier League squad that he's pulled together is good enough to win the World Cup again.
I've so loved listening to that story, because I've been fortunate enough to host two or three events with Gareth and the pair. I mean, we're not on the phone every 2 seconds, but we, you know, we'll have a little bit of correspondence here and there. But I do know what his ambitions are. And that point that you make about managing, actually, it's not just the media, but there's the whole politic involved as well, especially with some of the controversy of going off to Qatar. I mean, he has told me he spends as much time preparing for his media appearances in the run-up to a couple of games as he does actually preparing the coaching sessions. Now, obviously, you've just said Steve Holland took care of a block. He does have coaches. He's not neglecting the coaching side, but he is acutely aware, Phil, that everything he says, every slight emphasis on a sentence, every issue that he speaks on, is going to be scrutinized and has to be pitch perfect. And again, he does it brilliantly, doesn't he?
Well, he's borderline on controversy. It was only about a week ago when he said, I won't allow FIFA to gag me. And I thought, whoa, that's out there for Gareth. For me, you know, it's almost challenging the authority. It's almost saying, you're not going to, you know, if it's a political comment or a connotation that somebody asks me a question, you won't gag me. And I think, you've got to be careful, because that is the company that you're going, you know, you're representing it, albeit you're representing England, of course, in the Football Association, but FIFA are the hierarchy, as it were, and it's their tournament. So to a certain extent, I understand he wants to get his points of view across, even to the extent where he's now, you know, where the FA were concerned, they were thinking about, is it step down after the last tournament and move on to the next stage? Now, that's never been discussed in any England manager's role. The next stage being a director of the Football Association or something beyond management or higher than management, but still within the FA. And I think for me, that speaks volumes of what Gareth individually has done for our game, you know, from a national point of view. And I watch TV and watch Sky and some of the footage. And I was watching the 2008-2009 season, when we survived at Hull City in the Premier League, and it was one of my greatest achievements. And two of the three teams that went down, Alan Shearer at Newcastle and Gareth Southgate at Middlesbrough. How different paths have gone since then. You know, we've won things, we've lost things, it's just brilliant the way, for me personally, I'm looking at this going, I'm thinking, what did I do wrong? But I don't think you do in football. You don't do anything wrong. There's always a winner. And there's always a learner, is what I've been told, you know. And if you don't learn, you don't stay in the game. Well, I'm still in the game. So is Gareth, but he's at the highest level, and you know he's done a fabulous job, fabulous.
And I don't think we could argue too much with the squad he picked in the final analysis, even if it was an awareness of Gary Lineker, you know, shouting about James Maddison's claims or Alan Shearer shouting about Callum Wilson's claims. I look at that squad and I'm not sure there's anybody you could really argue should be in apart from those 26 there, is there, Phil?
I cover a lot of football for various reasons, you know the fact that you love football and the story. And I was at Newcastle Spurs and I'm watching a Newcastle team, but I'm watching Dan Burns in particular. And I'm thinking, the one thing that Harry Maguire has a problem with, forget about the politics of Harry Maguire, forget about Manchester United, forget about all of that. The one thing Harry Maguire, I think, has a problem with is when people throw him inside, and consequently, as a right-footed left centre-back, you will come inside naturally. You want to come inside because you're going onto your strongest foot. It's obvious. But when they shove you inside, they're now set for that first pass. And I just think we don't necessarily have that option of a left-footed centre-back that can actually open up the game down the left-hand side. When Harry plays, and I love the player, and I think he deserves to be there, no doubt about it, I'm just thinking, could we have added a left-footed centre-back to our squad? And he would have been the one for me.
I'm thinking about your answer there. And I guess there'll always be those, the odd example that somebody feels really strongly about, or maybe somebody has scrutinised a player for a long time. I'll still say to you, I think that's a fairly pretty much the squad that I would have personally picked to go. Not that obviously I know anything as much about football as you do. Now, I want to touch you quickly about Connor Wickham, who we've just heard from on this week's official EFL podcast. I wonder whether there is a point when a player has a more serious long-term injury where there's a stigma attached to them and it becomes very hard to fight it off, Phil.
Oh, I feel for him. I really do. I think, you know, when somebody gets that tag attached to them, you know, injury prone, there's all sorts of things, you know, what's been his issue? Why hasn't he played as many games as he should have done? Why has he got so many moves? There's all negativity surrounding probably the name, not the player, you know. And if you sit down with the lad, you probably recognise that there's a gem in there, you know. And he found himself at Forest Green Rovers. Unfortunately, not my hometown team out, which I don't like him for. certainly with the header that hit his shoulder and went in the back of the net. And then the shot from the halfway line was nothing short of class. And then you start analysing why is he playing at that level, and why hasn't, with that quality that he showed for the second goal against South Shields, that is the reason. As simple as that, that is the reason why he should have been playing at the top level. He could have been playing at the top level. He's not because of his body. You know, it's as simple as that. But I can only feel for people. I was so lucky, Clem. I was so lucky that I was 19, 20 when I first came into football. And then 15, 16 years later, you played over 700 games. So lucky to have very minimal injuries, if any, that kept me out for a long time. Certainly, I had a hamstring. I can remember a hamstring at Bolton Wanderers, and that's it, basically. And there will have been niggles. There will have been times where I shouldn't have played, but I did play. And that mentality of the coach telling you, listen, if you're 70, 75, get yourself out there. You'll get through the game because of your mentality. And all of them things were going on in my era and in my day. But where Connor's concerned, I mean, could he have had a better career? You can never look back like that. You've just got to take now every game as it comes and wish the best for him as a football person. I just wish the best for him. And I hope he does manage to get as many games and his goals as he possibly can get between now and the end.
Can he go back up, do you think? Will people take the positives out of him playing well at this level and go, do you know what? There's definitely one in there and he's proved himself playing 18 of 20 games or whatever his stats are. And somebody then may well take a chance and he might start moving up the pyramid again.
Clem, when you're saying playing well at that level, you expect him to. He's got the qualities. It's playing regular at that level is the key.
Yeah.
You know, 18 out of 20 games. If he starts going Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, right the way through, I would personally go, because I've chased Connor before. I can't remember whether it was Hull or Preston where I was looking at him. And, Chief Scout had match reports on him for sure. You know, go and have a look at him, take him, this, that and the other. I never eventually got to meet the lad. I think I spoke to his agent and, I didn't get a chance to sign him. But at the same time, you wonder why. Is his body breaking down? Is he not living his life properly? Is he not, is he not getting the right advice? You go through it all because advice is so important. You know, you've got so many medical people these days that are experts. You want to call them experts. You've got sports science departments. You've got sports science departments sometimes running football clubs. You're not telling the manager how tired you are and you shouldn't be playing and this, that, and the other. Connor Wickham hasn't got time for that. I can't be tired. I've got 5 or 6 years left of my career, as it were. And I'm 29 years old. If I get to 35 and I play another 300 games because of I'm out there week in and week out because of my mentality more than anything else, apart from sports science. My mentality is going to get me 35 and get another 200-300 games. That's got to be key. Now, if you get a manager like myself who would look at them numbers and also take into consideration the sports science side of the game, but more importantly, my opinion about the game, that's the one where you're sitting down with Connor and saying, I think he should play this weekend. I think he should play this weekend. And you get a trust, you get a belief between yourselves that, you know, if I think you're fatigued, I'll bring you off after 65, 70 minutes. But he'll then be saying, you're waiting for them beautiful words when he says, oh, that's when I score my goals. So he wants to stay on the field of play. They're the beautiful words you want to hear, you know.
Should we take a whistle stop around the Sky Bet Championship, which is almost at its halfway point? I'll chuck some names at you and see what you think. I mean, first of all, they played each other at the weekend. The two local rivals, Burnley came out on top against Blackburn. But have both managers impressed you in the job that they've done?
Very much so. Very much so. And some of the younger managers, the new ones, the up-and-coming ones, they have as well. Championship's a brutal division for any level of management. But the one thing you've got to say about Vincent Kompany is when his team plays, if they don't win, they don't lose. And that is going to be important. You come the end of the season when you see all that column with draws in and not so many losses, that is the mentality that comes from him. That is a mentality that it's born out of, okay, we'll accept the point in the 90th minute. Phil Neal used to say that to us at Bolton Wanderers. We'll accept the point in the 90th minute. And I always used to say to him, what does that actually mean? You know, we're getting to 90 minutes. I'm on the front foot. I want to go. Yeah, there's an element of being on the front foot, but there's also an element of that point may just get us promoted this year. That point may just take us to the title. That might.
Wait a minute, because Blackburn would argue, because they haven't drawn a single game, and they've lost so many games that they deserve to be on defeats. They would usually be just above or in the bottom three of the division. So we had this debate with Gary Rowett last week about whether an unbeaten run is to be coveted or whether it's better to go chuck in the kitchen sink and just win one, lose one, win one, lose one, win one, lose one, which would bring you a point a time per two games better than you would get than if you drew both of them.
But if you go back to them moments in the games, you know, you're coming into the last 10, 15 minutes of a game. Is it gung-ho time? And, you know, I'm talking about having learned from one of the best, you know, where Sam was concerned. He respected a point so much that it would be a case of, he knew when he was beaten. He also knew before the game that this is going to be a difficult game. I mean, dear me, we survived in the Premier League often enough at Bolton Wanderers against your greats. And I'm talking about your greats, your Manchester Uniteds and whatever, when they were flying high. But he also knew how to respect the point. But there's moments in your managerial career that will come and go where you go, should have done this, should have done that. You've got winners and you've got learners. So you haven't got winners and losers. You've got winners and learners. And I think what Vincent Kompany is saying, I'm learning on the job here and I'll take a point now. And come the end of the season, if I've got 14 draws and I've only lost a couple of games, will have been promoted.
That's why you've had the career you have. That's why I sit here ostensibly as a supporter. Now, I need you, on the basis of your wise old head, if you'll explain form to me. Okay, Sheffield United did briefly go top at the weekend before they were usurped again by Burnley, but they lost one of their first 11 and then they've lost four of their 10 since. And then I'll look at Norwich. No wins in the first three. Get this, Phil. Then Norwich wins 7 out of 8 and have now picked up just 2 wins in their last 10. Can you tell me how you can have such extremes in the space of a couple of months with exactly the same manager and exactly the same group of players?
The only thing you can weigh it up with for me is that character of the manager. It might be a gung-ho style of play, I don't know. But where Norwich are concerned, they've always been known. Always had the name tag of being a beautiful football club, playing beautiful football. Without being disrespectful, sometimes if you go there and be physical against them and stand up against them and don't allow them to do the nice stuff or the beautiful stuff, you've got a chance of getting something from that game. Now, you're learning on the job again, but you're looking at Norwich now, 7 games out of 8, none in 3, then 7 games out of 8. And you think to yourself, what kind of characters have I got in the changing room? Have I got characters that just, oh, I'll join in because everything's going well? or you got characters that go, "Ooh, hold on a second, you don't join in. We are part of something here. This is what we are." And the DNA comes out week in and week out. It sounds to me as if, I'm not being judgmental here, but it sounds to me as if they've got players that come on the day and perform on the day when everything's hunky-dory, everything's rosy. And it sounds to me like players that, "Oh, it's not too good today. I'm not going to turn up today." And you don't want that. You want a level of consistency within your change room. Now, only the manager can answer that question. And I'm not for 1 minute criticising Norwich City saying they've got no chance, because I know on the day they're one of the better clubs in the Championship, for sure. And they've got every chance, if they're in and around the playoffs, that confidence levels will be brimming. And that's the way Norwich is. They'll have full houses and, you know, they've every chance of winning the game of football because of impetus, you know. It's the things in the game of football, Clem, that are very difficult to measure. And a sports scientist here who actually does buy into it, how do you measure impetus? How do you measure momentum? How do you measure character? You know, how do you measure them things? It's very, very difficult. But when you get results, it's win or lose. Win or learn for me. Win or learn.
Last time he came on, which was at the end of September, we were all a little bit shocked. Rob Edwards had just been sacked as manager or head coach of Watford. Slaven Bilic had taken over. A little bit of a bumpy start for him. Lost three of his first five. He's now won four of his last six, and they are limbering up rather nicely. That experience he has got, obviously brought West Brom up a few years ago. Does that keep heads calm in moments when perhaps the points are not being put on the board?
I don't know, Slaven. I'm only talking about as a manager, watching interviews and listening to some of the stuff that comes out. He seems quite straight. He seems a happy guy. He seems a pleasant enough chap. I mean, you probably know him better than I do, Clem.
Met him a few times, yeah. And, you know, if he sat down and we weren't recording the conversation, he'd join in just like you and I would and be happily embracing and being enthusiastic about the aspects of football that you and I are.
At the same time, we've always got this defence mechanism. We've got this facade, if you like it. And you get behind the change room, you go, "Oh, I didn't quite see that in him." You know, I think you've got a winner in there. I think, just judging at certain things that he comes out with that I can't repeat, and it's not swear words, it's just how he is, I just think myself, when push comes to shove in that change room, he might be the kind of guy I'd like to follow. There's some great managers in that Championship. There's some great football clubs in that Championship. And it's never easy. We know that. It's probably the hardest division. But at the same time, you look at levels of support that are, I mean, Sunderland are mid-table at the moment, and they're just short of 40,000 average crowd. It's absolutely phenomenal. Again, a statistic that came out on Fighting Talk, they've got a bigger average than Juventus. They've got a big... And we are middle table. Talking about Sunderland here. We are middle table in the Championship, but we are top 10 in terms of crowd support in the English four divisions. Phenomenal. It's a great division. It really is. If Sunderland can just hang in there, you never know. They might just nick into the playoffs, I'm hoping.
I'm not going to slip down to Skybet League One yet, but while you're talking crowds and it's fresh in my mind, I must just mention as well, Derby County took 6,700 to MK Dons at the weekend. I mean, goodness gracious me. These numbers are nuts, aren't they?
I did Derby County's, the BBC show that they do on the Friday night, and Dom Dietrich got me on it, and we were chatting away, and they were talking this, that, and the other, and everything was going, you know, it was after the 0-0 draw at Anfield, actually, when they got beat up penalties, and the support that they took to Anfield, and they were eulogising about it, and this, that, and the other, and I went back to my Bolton Wanderers day. I was very fortunate to go to Anfield under Bruce Rioch, and we beat Liverpool at Anfield 2-0, and we took 9.5. Now, Derby compared to Bolton Wanderers. Mm. Bolton Wanderers, you can walk to Liverpool, couldn't you, down the M62. It's a lot closer. But the comparison's not between the two clubs. It's just them nights and what they give you. What them nights give you. You know, we've won 2-0. We're applauding 9,500 travelling supporters. I turn round and the cop is still full. And they are applauding us 10 minutes after the game because we didn't try and kick them off the park. We tried to play football against them. And it was a level of respect. But what I was trying to say to Dom and to the Derby County fans is what that gives you is something a little bit special as a player. You know, you it almost you release the bubble, you release the top of the champagne cork, as it were, and the belief just starts to flow, and you start doing things in a football match that you haven't maybe done before. Not trying silly things, I'm just, you're on the front foot, you're doing things that you watched Liverpool do all your life, and now you've beaten them, and you just think, well maybe this is, and it gives you a new, so I don't know, a spring to your step, a new lease of life. And we went on a good cup run then because of that belief that it gave us. And I was saying to the guys at Derby, wouldn't surprise me if that Derby County team then turns up against MK Dons and does the business. And he went, yeah, we've got 6,500 going to the game. And I'm like, whoa. You know, you've got to be staring at a Derby County win. And I know MK Dons have not had a great start to the season. I think they're in the bottom four, which surprises me. But having said that, Scotty Twine leaving, I think, is a big reason for that. But they couldn't not turn. I mean, £4 million to Burnley, they couldn't turn that down. They had to take it.
Yeah. I'm going to come to Sky Bet League One in a minute. I just want to finish off in the Sky Bet Championship. West Brom coming out of the bottom three, Carlos Corberan, three consecutive wins. But we've got to talk about Wigan Athletic, who did beat Blackpool at the weekend, but only after Liam Richardson has lost his job, having picked up just a point from the last possible 21, which was 20 odd days. He signed a new contract on the 25th of October. On the 10th of October, they were 2 points off the playoffs. I mean, I'm struggling with this one a little bit. You know, what happens between the belief of giving a manager a contract on the 25th of October and just 20 days later, he's losing his job?
It disappoints me from the world of football. We've painted such a bad picture of how we deal and how we treat managers, to the extent where you can give somebody a 3-year deal and 16 days later you're pulling it, not just pulling the deal from him, you're actually sacking the guy. You opened up, the opening gambit to the question was 1 point from 21. That's the reason why you lose your job. Forget about the rest of it. So I'm going to lose my job because I've got 1 point from 21. Why did you give me a contract, a 3-year contract 16 days ago? It's just the wrong message. From a football perspective, that is, Clem, that, you know, from the global, you know, what are people in the world thinking of English football, and more importantly, English football managers? Are we ever going to be that successful English football manager that's going to win the Premier League, say, for instance? Well, we're knocking at the door. We're getting there. We're getting closer with the likes of Eddie Howe. Great, fantastic. And, you know, Graham Potter's, you know, gone into Chelsea. At least you're getting English managers getting big jobs.
Yeah.
What are you actually saying to everybody else? I honestly thought there was something else going to come out, because I just couldn't believe the timing of it, you know. And then somebody told me that, well, apparently there was every chance Liam Richardson was going to go to another football club, and that's the reason why they gave him a 3-year deal. Well, is that the reason for giving somebody a 3-year deal? It beggars belief. It really does.
Do football managers take the blame too much? Have they become too much of a scapegoat for a club not achieving an owner's ambitions?
Well, I hear stories because I'm still involved in football, regardless of whether you're in management or not. You're still going to games, you're doing media work. And I hear stories, unbelievable stories, about, you know, managers walking in and taking all their own staff. And, you know, Unai Emery's just gone into Aston Villa. He's took, I think, 9-10 backroom staff with him, all well and good. You know, what happens to the staff going out? Is it all Stevie Gerrard? Is it Stevie Gerrard and one other? Or how many? It can't be 9 out, 9 in. It won't be anything as transient as that. I wouldn't have thought so. But there'll be people hovering around now at Aston Villa that they're in transit. They're in limbo, sorry, not in transit. They're in limbo and they're not going anywhere in their careers. But the point about management is, yes, we understand it falls upon you. Yes, your backroom staff have to be trustworthy to the extent where, you know, you have to be all singing from the same hymn sheet, all on the same page. You have to trust your backroom staff. Going to the extent of 10 backroom staff, you know, that's a luxury I couldn't afford. But at the same time, at Hull City, I built up a backroom staff, but it was built on trust and knowledge and belief and experience. And, you know, I can't even, Brian Horton and Steve Park, and I can't think of anybody better in that situation I was in to have them behind me. Having said that, they'd over 1,500 games between the two of them. So they could have walked into my position at any one given time. No problem at all. They could have done my role, no problem. But that pushed me to be better a better Phil Brown or a better manager. And that pushed me at that moment in time. So we understand that you're going to lose your job, but you have to have a backroom staff that you trust that will keep you in work. And until that moment happens, you know, if you haven't got a backroom staff that do that, they're not a backroom staff. They're not really the type of people that you need or want, shall we say. But, you know, the Liam Richardson situation for me, the 1 in 21 got him out of work, but it didn't necessarily get him a 3-year deal, if you know what I'm saying.
I do know what you're saying. So, just to clarify, well, I was going to say no championship fixtures till the weekend of the 10th of December, but I did spot that Sunderland play Millwall. Those two have played one game less than most other clubs in the championship, and they're actually going to play on the 3rd of December. If the next question, listeners to the official EFL podcast, is why is that? The answer is, I haven't the foggiest idea. But anyway, championship football, one game on the 3rd of December, but the rest of you, we're going to have to wait until the 10th of December for the pickup. I want to move into Sky Bet League One. We've already mentioned Derby. They moved into the top six after their win at MK Dons. A couple of clubs that are near to you geographically. Wickham, not really got going yet. 7 wins out of 18 so far, of course, losing playoff finalists. Oxford slightly improving. Only 6 wins so far, but 2 have been an unbeaten last 5. Why do you think that Gareth Ainsworth and Carl Robinson's team, why do you think they've had a little bit of a spluttering start, Phil?
I think if you know both guys, and I know them both fairly well, you know, as well as you'll know any managers, you know. I go to the games. Carl's a great guy, served his apprenticeship under Sam at Blackburn, and it's phenomenal the experience that Carl's got. And I honestly look at Carl and I look at Gareth at the same time, and I look at these guys on a touchline, and they are motivators. They are absolute off the map with regards to how they get a team going. And when the team goes, when the team starts flowing, it's almost like, well, it's difficult. You know, you can just see the juices flowing with regards to their teams. And I watched Oxford at the start of the season. They were struggling. And they were struggling for a couple of reasons. His better players weren't playing well. And if they weren't playing well, he was leaving them out. And consequently, you know your better players eventually are going to win your games of football. It's as simple as that. But when they're not playing well, what do? You've got to give somebody else a chance. So consequently, it took Carl a while to get his best team out. But now he's got his best team out, I think, in my opinion. He'll start flowing now. And it wouldn't surprise me if, again, he knocks at the door of the playoffs. Last year, he was in the playoffs all the way through and then fell by the wayside at the end. This year, I think it's going to be a case of building up. It'll be foreign to Carl because he'll be looking at that league table thinking, we're better than this, we're better than this, we're better than this. But he's just slowly but surely coming. And if he keeps that momentum, again, a big word, if he keeps that impetus flowing towards now and the end of the season, and I know, you know, we're a third of the way through or nearly a half of the way through, it wouldn't surprise me if Carl nicks into the playoffs and gets promoted this year. But I don't want to put any pressure on him. Where Gareth's concerned, similar kind of person, similar kind of feel. But he has this 20-man squad where he won't go past a certain figure, you know, and it's always one in and one out. And sometimes it takes its time to bed in. And I think possibly that might be a little bit of an issue that, you know, sometimes you've just got to get on with the fact that you've got 11 happy people, you've got 7 sitting on the bench and not so happy, and then you've got 5 or 6 in the stand.
Well, wait a second, Phil. I mean, there is the fact that they reached the playoff final and then your lot beat them as well. And I guess, I mean, that's a hell of an achievement for Wickham to get promoted, come back down, and then get so close to promotion again. That's got to be an emotional scar that you need to overcome, hasn't it?
But I think he's got the capabilities, Gareth. He's been scarred a few times, and he just comes out smiling. You cannot keep a good man down, and he's a good man.
Did somebody I'm talking to now create one of those emotional scars a few years ago? did somebody I'm talking to now's team leave Gareth on the losing side in a playoff final? Do I recall?
This is what I'm talking about. There's winners and there's learners. You know, you don't lose in football. You just got to get up in the next morning, dust yourself down and get on with it, Clem. You know the score.
Exactly, I do. So your Sky Bet League One fixtures this coming weekend. Friday, 5th v 6th, Portsmouth against Derby. Ipswich in second, head to Exeter in a 12 o'clock kickoff. Peterborough, who are currently fourth, lost last week, and they go to Bristol Rovers. Plymouth, still the magnificent leaders. They go to Burton. Wickham themselves are at Cheltenham. Oxford are at home to Forest Green. And Sheffield Wednesday in third. They entertain Shrewsbury Town.
What a job Steve Schumacher's doing, isn't he?
Oh, magnificent, isn't he? I mean, it's 11 wins in an unbeaten last 14 matches. That is sensational form. There's a few teams just starting to improve in League Two that have taken my eye, particularly Stockport, who I think everybody fancied. Only won three of their first 13, suddenly have won four out of five and are heading up towards the promotion areas. Ended up on the same train as the whole of Wimbledon as they were on their way back from Salford. Again, three wins out of 13, but then suddenly three out of five. And I wanted to mention Crawley as well, where Ashley Young's brother Lewis has taken over. I felt a bit sorry for Kevin Betsy. He only won one of their first 12. Suddenly he's taken over, three wins and an unbeaten five. There can be various reasons for an upturn, can they not? I suppose you've got Stockport, upturn, and Wimbledon, same personnel, suddenly managed to find gears. Obviously, in the case of Crawley, the manager had to take the hit and be changed to get some sort of effect.
Again, you know, you're looking at the second division. I always look at the teams that I've managed there as well. You know, Swindon, I've been to see them a couple of times, playing some good football. I think they've got one of the Welsh squad, isn't it?
Johnny Esther's there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's one or two massive clubs in there, as we say, in the first division. It's exactly the same. Your Plymouths, your Portsmouths and your Ipswich. There's some big clubs and big scalps. I'm looking at Barrow and how well they're doing, you know. Under the guidance of Pete Wild, who's cut his teeth at Halifax Town. And they, you know, you're talking about, again, it's an insecurity, I think. The lower down you go, you almost, you look at your great coaches and they almost look unbeatable. You can't break them down. You can't, you know, they haven't got weaknesses. And it's sometimes it's a grudge to watch it, you know, because surely they must have a weakness. Surely you can get at them somehow. But the lower down you come, them weaknesses are exposed and we seem to go under the lower down you go, you know. So you have runs of great success and you have runs of failure. And runs of great success and runs of failure. And it seems to, I don't know why at the lower end, it seems to manifest itself a little bit more. But Crawley, I don't know, it's a very tidy club, very neatly run. It's had its moments over the years, but you know, it's not really an intimidating place. You need places to be intimidating, you know. And I think if you go to Stockport, that can be an intimidating place. You're right on top, the crowd's right on top of you. You know, you've got your passionate northern fans versus your nice southern fans, etc. I can't start that argument, can I? But it's still brilliant to watch some of the football in the second. The fourth tier of English football is still a great, you know, people are trying to play the right football is what I'm trying to say.
3 o'clock kickoffs in Sky Bet League Two this coming weekend. Fifth place Barrow entertaining Phil's old team Hartlepool. It's fourth v third as Bradford entertain Northampton Town. Bradford just 2 points behind Northampton. Stevenage in second go to Grimsby. Mansfield in seventh head to Harrogate. Stockport entertain the leaders Leyton Orient. Another one of Phil's former teams, Swindon, currently in sixth. They entertain Crewe. Wimbledon head to Tranmere and Crawley head to Walsall. Phil, seriously, are you going to be wall-to-wall World Cup? Are you just trying to organise everything to be at home with your telly switched on from almost first thing in the morning and just go back to back to back to back to back?
No, I've got an invite to go out to India for a couple of months over the Christmas period.
Oh.
The Rise Worldwide are sort of running the show over there. It used to be IMG, Reliance. Rise Worldwide have took over, and so they want me to go and be an expert analyst over there and do a few core comms.
When does that start then? When is that?
That'll be the back end of November up until probably February. But the family's coming out over the Christmas. Monty's going to have his first little spell in India with Jade and Eva, my missus. So they're coming out for the Christmas period. So it's going to be Christmas in Mumbai for the Browns.
Wow, what a wonderful! You love that country, don't you? You've got under your skin.
It's got to me. It's almost like back in the day where Hartlepool got under my skin and the rest is history, as it were. I don't know. It's not a case of wanting to live there or wanting to be there all the time or whatever. It's just it's been a nice process. The last 3 or 4 years have been part and parcel of the development of it. You know, when it first started, the ISL, everyone just went there for the money and basically just took the money and ran and weren't giving any kind of input on and off the field of play. So consequently, the players weren't improving. And they're so willing over there. You know, the work rate and the ethic of the young players, of the Indian talent, are so willing. Eventually, they will be represented, I would have said, in Europe or in England at some stage on a more regular basis because of the attitude, you know, the work rate. I can't fault them for work rate. The quality will have to come. The quality will come because of the foreign players that are over there need to spend more time educating. This is what it's all about to survive maybe in Europe or in England. But it'll eventually happen. I mean, it's only in its infancy, 9 years. I think the ISL's 9 years old. My former club's just won it last year and they're top of the league again this year. And Man City have invested in Mumbai City. So they're second at the moment. So Hyderabad's flying high. And I'm going to go over there, I hope, at the right time. And catch a few, I don't know, Christmas in Mumbai. I can't believe I'm doing it.
My goodness me. I promised people when I introduced you, it would be a broad-ranging discussion. We've gone from the World Cup through the EFL's three divisions. The FA Cup got a mention in there as well. I think the League Cup might have got a mention. And now we finish off with the ISL. Unbelievable. Why didn't you mention the Football League trophy? Then you could have got the full set, Phil. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers, Clem. Thank you very much.
That is it for this episode. A big thank you to Phil Brown and to Connor Wickham. If you've enjoyed it, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.